me funny like I'm a clown? I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the f*** are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
What the f*** is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker! Do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
Now's my shit together, is my shit together.
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control. Right here.
Feel more volume, Jimmy.
We are live.
Lone Wolf Pack, Stocks and Jocks. Talking about Jim Waller on the board. S&P futures down 19. Oh, wait a minute. That was yesterday. Wait a minute here. Let me get the pre-market up here. S&P futures down 10. NASDAQ futures down 54. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I'm doing okay. Just for your edification, significant snowfall up at the ski areas a couple of days ago. Eight inches of snow at Loveland and Loveland Pass, and not quite as much at places like Breck and Vail, but Rabbit Ears Pass, which is up by Steamboat, got 4 or 5 inches. So winter is coming.
Have you ever skied up at Loveland?
No.
You ever gone over it?
Say again?
You ever gone over it? I never have.
I'm sorry, have you ever gone where?
Over, I mean, never used Loveland Pass instead of the tunnel.
Oh, yeah, I've driven over Loveland Pass in the wintertime.
Well, I've always used the tunnel.
It's terrifying.
That's what I was
there
thinking.
Avalanche. I mean, when I say it's terrifying because there are avalanche signs everywhere. Driving along, and I mean, the road itself, two things. The first thing is you ask yourself, who the heck thought this was an alternative route to do anything?
Well, it wasn't. It was the first route.
Because you climb way, way, way up above the Colorado River or whatever it is that runs down there along I-70, and you just sort of look around and go, this was an idiotic thing for somebody to call a pass, but as you drive the road, there are avalanche warnings all along the road, and it's quite something.
Well, that was the first way through. That's Route 6.
Yeah.
And when they say a pass actually is a pass. It's the low spot, kind of in the mountains in that area, right? I mean, and they call that a pass. It's a relatively easy.
It's a low spot, but it's it's a low spot in the sense that there's higher, you know, there are higher peaks around you.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But the much easier route is the route cut by the river that's like 3,000 feet below you.
Well, but the river doesn't go through the divide.
The river, the route for Route 70. Runs straight from Denver all the way through to Utah, and it's cut through a canyon, or it runs through a canyon cut by parts, at least in large part, by the Colorado River.
I understand it, but I'm saying is there's a tunnel through the divide for 70.
There is, but that tunnel's not very close to Loveland Pass. Loveland Pass is
it's not that far.
No, in any event.
Well, what I'm saying is a whole different program if you're going to go through rather than over.
It doesn't resemble much like Hoosier Pass, which is near Breckenridge. Hoosier, you know, Loveland Pass, I think, is what, 11,000 feet. So you got to go up to like 11,000 feet before you get to a quote low spot, and Hoosier Pass is the same way.
And well, did you ever go north on 40, take Burthout?
Burthed Pass, yes.
That's sort of the same thing. You're back and forth until you get up there where, what's the ski resort there, Winter Park? That's when you're coming down. That thing is way the hell up there. You're going left, you're going right. I mean, you're the, what do they call them, the hook backs or something backs?
Yeah, you ask yourself, there must have been an easier way to do this, but they just didn't. They just weren't in a hurry to find us.
I think the answer is, rather than drilling through, that was the easy way.
I don't think so. But there are rivers that and valleys that go down through there that I would have thought would have provided an easier, maybe safer.
I never want to give a geology lesson to my friend Lou, but I got news for you: no river cuts through the divide, hence the name Divide.
That's at the point of the Continental Divide. That's true.
Well, that's where the Eisenhower Tunnel is. It goes right through the divide, right?
It does. The Eisenhower Tunnel is right. I think it's right on the Continental Divide, or right in that.
And
right
a couple miles area. Away is the railroad tunnel, Moffett Tunnel.
Yeah,
the weird part is, what was the name of the Sierra Nevada when they're trying to find the easiest way to get the trains through the Sierra Nevada? Sierra Nevadas are actually in some spots almost tougher to get through than the Rockies, right?
Not
quite as high, but
I think that's right. It's a slightly newer mountain range, so it's steeper, right?
Yeah,
it's part of the Canadian. If you follow that up, you hit the Canadian Rockies, which are very young mountains.
Who are the people that ate each other?
The Donner Party.
Yeah, well,
Donner Pass.
They were trying to get through, right. And they were using the Donner Pass, which was the relatively, when I say relatively, as you just said it, it's 10,000 feet instead of 10,500, but it's the relatively easy way to get through, and they made it up top and they got snowed in. Right. Well, when they went to build the railroad, the surveyor said, "Guess what? The Donner family was right. This is the easiest way through."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they were. Yeah. Excuse me. Got something in my throat. They were on the. They were on the right route. They just totally misestimated the onset of winter.
Yeah.
I don't think I told this story, but I've told it since I got back from France in June, that whole gradient thing. So the Romans had this whole area and settled in all of southern France, and one of the things they did is they put, we talked about the aqueducts and how they did that, how they measured the gradients, and the Romans were particularly good at that. And if you look at the roads that they cut through the Dolomites and the Alps, it's astounding how they measured those passes and all that. I think they did a better job at road building than we did.
Well, the people who did the I love it when you get me into my railroad history. The people who built the railroad going west, Carl didn't like it when I dragged up the article about the law trying to force the Chinese people back to China after they were done building it, because we don't want them anymore. If you look, the road is like right next to I-80. It's maybe a half mile away, all the way west. Well, guess what? I-80 was specked out by satellite. And the other thing was specked out by guys on horseback with Indians shooting at them.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, these people did pretty good job.
We consistently underestimate the technical capacity of our ancestors. I wanted to just, I was looking at my things I wanted to talk about, and there's lots of crazy stuff to go on if you want to talk current events. But the first thing
before,
I want to talk
hey,
about,
before you start, our friend James, our producer today, went to the Cub game last night, and because the tickets came from somewhere else, he actually had to go to the ticket window.
This is a perfect segue.
Don't go ahead. I'm not asking you how old you are. If you're like 65 or something, have a jitterbug phone, a flip, and decide you want to go to a ball game with cash, stay home. No cash. Yeah. If you don't have a phone, you can't get in.
Yeah.
Is it?
That doesn't surprise me.
But the thing that surprises me, Lou, and I'd love your opinion on this, is when I try and have this marketing mind. I was chairman of the marketing committee of the SIBO for 4 years. I try to this marketing mind. What is it about the modern mindset? How, I use the term my mother used to say, brainwashed. How brainwashed are we when if I say something like that, people say, "You're an idiot. You're the Luddite. This is the way it is." And I say, "Wait a minute. I'm the customer. They're not. Well, why are you defending them? If I want to pay cash and don't want to bring a phone to the game, Who's to tell me I can't get in? I mean, and if they don't want me, I guess they don't want me. But I can't believe that at the end of the day, this doesn't cost them people at these games. Even if it's 10 people a game or a bunch of old farts like me that you don't want there anyway. I don't know. But you can't tell me that making things inconvenient for other people is good marketing. And yet people argue with this all day long. Where am I wrong here?
I'm not going to argue with you. I mean, the customer is always right. But in this case, the vast majority of customers are carrying those phones because it's convenient and it's safer and it's more secure and it eases the transaction costs for the for both the seller and the buyer.
Well, they're not cheaper.
No, they're not. But when I say it eases the transaction costs, it provides an incentive for the seller to use it because it increases their profit margin. But I'm of the personal opinion, getting as I get older, that intelligent cell phone use makes life a lot easier for senior citizens.
I'm not denying that. Roger Goodell doesn't need to know that I went to the ball game last night.
I agree. You attach, and you always have, attach a value to privacy that I'll just tell you, a lot of people, and I'm sort of with you on this, but a lot of other people don't, and especially younger people who apparently have absolutely no thoughts about how the fact that their location, their shopping habits, all of this that is recorded on a modern cell phone can be accessed, commercialized, everything. They don't think about that. It's just become part of the, you talk about fish being in the ocean and not realizing they're in the ocean. It's part of the ocean, the digital ocean in which they swim. And the convenience of being able to, for example, not have to look at a map where you're going.
What's a map?
Yeah, you just tell your phone, I want to go here, and the phone takes you there. I was with my oldest and his wife and was explaining to them just what I had to do to plan a trip, and using road maps. And I said every car had one of these giant map books in it,
yeah,
so that you could figure out where you were. And when you got into navigating in cities, directions, you had to have directions from whoever was, wherever you were going, to landmarks and things like that to get you down to the final, two blocks or block or two of the destination. And so it just took a lot more effort.
And at the end of the day, you were smarter.
I think that's right. I really do. I mean, one of the things that we've discovered, and I'm sure I've mentioned this on the air, a long time ago, but one of the things we've discovered with the use of automated legal research, it used to be if you were going to go find a case citation, you had to go, as they said, into the stacks. You would go into the law library. Every law firm had either itself a giant law library or access to one. You would go into the law library.
Didn't you pay a service to maintain all that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. West Publishing built its, and which I think now is part of Reuters, but I'm not sure. Anyway, West Publishing. There were two major publishing houses in the United States that did nothing but publish case law, and these books, you would the first thing you would do, you were handed an assignment. You went in and you looked up legal terminology in something called Corpus Juris Secundum, which was this giant legal dictionary that gave you, sort of the basic outline of law. You then got terms that you would go into a West publication, and you would look for what are called key terms, and that was the West's research system, was this keynote system. You would find those key terms, look them up in the West publishing system, and then look for recent cases that listed those key terms. You would then go find those cases in the books. You would have to read, because you had to go scan through the case to find the pertinent section of the court's opinion that that referred to the issue you were trying to resolve. You'd find that. You'd read that case very carefully, because it would give you other citations to other cases. You'd write all this down. You'd look up those other cases until you found a case that seemed to be reasonably on point. Once you got that, then you would go and say, okay, this is the case I'm going to lead with. I'm going to cite these other cases, but I have to make sure they're good law. So you would then engage in the mechanical process of what's called shepherdizing. And you would look in a separate set of volumes that would tell you whether that case had been reversed or criticized or questioned.
Are they listed, listed by number or by name?
They were typically listed by citation number. So you would go in and look for that citation number and then check whether it had been questioned. Now, the court opinions, of course, are coming out every day. So you would look in first the Shepherd's hardcover volumes, and then you would look in the softcover Shepherd's, which was more recent decisions, and then you would go to what were called the Shepherd's advance sheets, which were actually thin paper inserts that would go into the softcover books to make sure that you had the most up-to-date system. What you got out of doing that, in addition to making it incredibly expensive for the client to do that kind of research, but what you got from that, though, was as you read all of this case law, is you got an appreciation not just of the issue that you were trying to find, but everything else that the court talked about, because you had to read the whole case. When digital legal research arrived, it takes you right to the section of each case that you're looking for with the terms that you're looking for.
Well, if you don't read the paragraph before and after, you might get the wrong spot.
That's right. And it takes it. Moreover, you lose the sense of how a court has reached that opinion. And you lose a lot of collateral information about, oh, this is how these kinds of cases get decided. Oh, this is what a multi-district litigation decision looks like. You don't pick up that stuff because you're just looking at that snapshot of the case. And one of the things we've worked hard at, and law schools, I think, are starting to push, is telling legal students and junior lawyers, you got to read the whole decision. You find the decision.
Well, that has to go over like a fart in church.
It not only creates problems with the associates in terms of needing to do this research. It means that you're literally multiplying the hours that it takes to look at this stuff and find it and get the context and get the understanding, and clients don't want to pay for that.
Oh, I get it.
But in terms of what your life is like, it is infinitely more pleasurable to get online and do research that will pull up 15 or 20 cases that are exactly on point.
Lou, as much as I rail on this stuff, when I look up something during the day or during the show, it is a hell of a lot easier to see the AI pop up on the Google than it is for me to go through four different websites. But if it's something important, I'll go through them anyway to make sure the AI is right.
Oh, yeah. Well, Tom, I can now feed my opponent's legal brief on an issue. I can feed that into an AI on Lexis or Westlaw and tell it, I want you to write an opposition to this.
Really?
And it will in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it will give you not a brilliant piece of legal writing, but it will give you a credible response with accurate case citations. Now, you have to check every one of them to make sure it hasn't misconstrued a case. But the days when, and I wonder how many of our clients are going to just finally just their general counsel are just going to finally say, you know what, the AI version is close enough, rather than paying, you know, Lou, you know, X dollars per hour.
Boy, I don't know about
associates
that.
X dollars per hour. I'm going to go with this pretty good solution rather than get the human being involved.
Remember the Star Trek episode when the guy had the law books? Spock says to him, "What are you doing with books? It's all on the computer." He goes, "Not the same." He was the best attorney in the galaxy. Just saying.
That was from, I think, season one.
Yeah.
It was the episode where the guy had tried to frame Kirk.
Yeah.
For killing him.
And he wasn't dead.
No, he was hiding in the ship.
Hey, I got it. Here's the thing, and then I want to get on to what you want to talk about. But here's the thing I have the most trouble, I think, communicating to people, Lou, and it's, I'm sure you do too, in some area of the law that nobody gets, me or anybody. You can't even really talk about it. But my little, you know, jig about the tickets is the part that I try and maybe because I was coming to a couple of professors I had at the University of Chicago, Milton Friedman being one of them, whenever they asked, you know, they tell you what a policy is on a business or whatever, they'd say, work this through the next 5 or 10 years, what are all the ramifications of it? The first thing they would do is they would tell you, assume a monopoly, assume free competition, assume a cartel. And every one of the answers was different. And the thing, you know, Jimmy and I were jousting about the tickets and the phones, just like you and I were doing. But now, you can't forget the fact, in my mind, that Major League Baseball is a monopoly. It shouldn't be, but it is. And they can do whatever they goddamn please to people, and you got to bend over and take it. Now, you go to the Windy City Thunderbolts game, the thought of them locking a family out that comes up with cash and don't have a phone is the furthest thing from their mind. Why would they ever do that? That's the customer. It's their job to count the cash and have somebody not steal it. It's not your job to worry about their guy stealing their cash. I mean, the difference in the answer to the exam question is dramatically different in any area that's kind of free competition versus other. When are the last time you went into your local barber or your local bar and they told you don't take cash? Yet if there was one company that had all the barbers in the world, they probably would say, we're not taking cash. We're afraid our people are going to steal. Well, whose problem is that? Yours or mine?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you.
But I don't... The subtlety of this, because we have so many firms getting bigger and bigger and bigger and the only place you can go... I mean, I don't know what you would do. I would go... Well, I won't go nuts, but if I was in some small western town and the only bank there was Wells Fargo. In Illinois, we're blessed with, you know, there's 10 banks within 4,000 yards at office. But I mean, what this when you get to an area where there's no competition, I don't know, I guess it's just not other people don't think of it. And I do constantly because that was my training. I guess that's my fault, not theirs.
But this is a function of the Cubs, right? I mean, Major League Baseball doesn't say,
oh, no,
they can't take cash. This is all locals.
No, the Sox don't know either.
Yeah.
Sox won't even take cash to park the car. I want to give that guy my American Credit Express credit card with some machine in the parking lot? Really? I pull out $30, which is ridiculous to park. Oh, no, you can't park. I go, there's 3 cars in the lot. What are you talking about? There literally were three cars in the lot. I mean,
that's an interesting, you know, something like that. That's an interesting question about the advantage of using, you know, digital pay. Maybe so I'm still not comfortable with using my phone to pay for things.
I'm not either. You remember Matty Weber? He was in security and online security. That's his real job. He said the last thing you want to do is put your credit card. The only app I have on my phone, believe it or not, is for the Chicago parking thing. He said, don't ever put your parking your American Express card in one of those things. You're out of your mind. Do I want to stick it in the guy's little handheld in the White Sox parking lot?
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with that because I worry about the transaction costs and all that. And yet, I know that my Google app automatically records my credit cards, and when I want to pay for something online, when I'm buying something on Amazon or something like that, it throws up my credit cards at me, pops them up and says, okay, which one of these credit cards do you want to use?
I always just kick in the number for that particular transaction. I don't know anybody who has my credit card, well, that I know of online.
Yeah, it's, and again, it comes down to, okay, this is really convenient. And as an old person, who sometimes finds it difficult to keep track of, you know, exactly where all my, you know, where my credit card is or my credit card information, or I don't have my wallet with me and I don't want to have to fill the stupid form out by hand. It's incredibly convenient and probably in a number of ways more secure. Didn't used to be that way, but I think it is now.
Well, as long as it's kind of your choice, Lou, I really don't mind. I may go to the Myers every Sunday or Saturday whenever I'm out in the burbs, and they have the M Perks, right? You got to kick in your number. Now, I know that they're tracking everything I do at the Myers with the M Perks number, but I also know I'm buying cash, I'm buying eggs, I'm buying gas, I buy pork sausages for the office. You know what? Once a month or once every 6 weeks, I get $1 off on gas. I run my tank down and I get 24 gallons. I save $24. I'm making the decision, I think intelligently or not, that for them seeing what brand of breakfast sausage I buy for the office and how much gas I get in my truck, they can have that information, okay, because I don't buy anything else there. But that, as long as it's my call, I'm okay with it. But I think there's a difference in why does everybody have to know I go to the ball game on Thursday night? I mean, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of Hispanic families out at some of these suburban baseball games that if you track them there, they wouldn't be there.
Well, so, I mean, if you have a smartphone, you know, and I think most of us do now, yeah. But if you have a smartphone...
Mine's not that bright because I'm using it, but it's a smartphone.
The phone's tracking your location anyway. So, I mean, if somebody wanted to find out that you were at the ball game, it would be, I think, reasonably easy or to make that location.
Probably.
I sort of accept that, again, for the ease of being able to navigate strange places without having to have, you know, a piece of paper taped to the dashboard with the directions written down on it. Anyway, let me follow up on the Cubs thing. So you guys have a player named Matt Shaw.
Yeah.
Who blew off
one game
to go attend a funeral and apparently got roasted for it.
Well, some people.
So was there an upset in Chicago over this?
No.
Because the Cubs lost the game that he missed.
No, I mean I think from the Cubs' point of view, you know, and I'm interpreting this, Jimmy, please pile in it. I think the suddenness of it didn't allow him to bring a guy up from AAA, so they actually started the game one man short, and there was a point in the game where they could have used a pinch hitter, and they didn't have one. So I think I don't know what the notice was or something. That seemed to be the issue, not the fact that this is just my opinion. From what I'm reading, there's not some big hue and cry. You know, Lou, I'm the biggest funeral and wake goer there is. If I know somebody, I'm going to their funeral and wake. And this guy liked the guy. And as long as he gave everybody notice and said, hey, get somebody up from AAA, I'm not going to be here tomorrow, I don't have any problem with it. Do you?
Okay.
I mean, that's just me personally. But if all of a sudden, where the hell is he? You know, then I got a problem with it.
Yeah, it was an interesting question because, you know, a lot of places, and I don't know if Illinois has a mandatory bereavement leave.
Oh, I don't think so. I never heard of it.
For employees. Most companies have a bereavement leave policy for, you know, typically it's for the death of a family member or a close family member. But, you know, where they will give you unpaid time off or even paid time off for funeral, whatever. He apparently was good friends with Kirk. They had lived in the same apartment building and apparently Kirk was, would send him, you know, texts after every game, basically saying, hey, I just, you know, great, good job, etc. And the guy's widow, Kirk's widow, essentially reached out to Shaw personally and said, hey, I'd really like it if you can make the service.
I have zero problem with that, unless he did it without telling, which I can't imagine he did.
No, I mean, it was all that took place in less than a week. They got the whole thing organized. So I'm guessing. I wondered if there was any pushback in Chicago.
I'm sure there's somebody who's pissed off about it. There's somebody pissed off about the fact that Jimmy and I walked across the expressway this morning, right? There's somebody pissed off about something, but you just got to ignore it.
It came up on my radar here because apparently the Cincinnati Reds, that's who you guys were playing when he left, the Reds announcers were making light of it and saying this isn't really, you know, what you do for your teammates and stuff like that.
Luke, people have different views of this, and I think you know where mine are. You know, I'm a Southside Catholic, for God's sake. I tell people in the trading pit, I'm going to wake tonight. Where are you going? One of my friend's mothers. What the hell are you going to your friend's mother's wake for? I said, you don't understand. I organized football and basketball games for 20 years. Every time I called the guy's house, I had a 5-minute conversation with his mother. She was like my mother. What's the matter with you? Tell me what wake I should go to or not.
Yeah, I don't have any problem.
If you feel that you should be there, you should be there, in my opinion.
So this
is that,
this
is that fair or not?
It obviously can be taken to an extreme, but this is a case where if I were the Cubs, I would have said go and
Who is the you're not gonna answer this question, Jimmy? Had to be the greatest wake goer ever. Richard Daley the first. He'd average like 2-3 wakes a night. Now, tell me you won't vote for the guy who shows up at your uncle's wake. He knew everybody, and that's how he knew everybody. He cared about everybody. It wasn't perfect, but
no. I just saw that, and I just thought, I'll raise that.
Let me answer it a different way. I think a bunch of people have tried to get a rise out of people, and they haven't been able to.
Yeah, this may have been driven by the fact that Kirk was a controversial, polarizing figure, and maybe somebody was just trying to stir the pot with that, and maybe that's why it popped up
Most of the liberal people I know, Lou, honestly, that I hang around with, are all Catholic churchgoers. Not one of them had a problem with it.
No,
that this guy's somebody's buddy, and you went.
So next sports question, because I'm leading with sports this morning, because I don't want to talk about necessarily all the other craziness that's going on.
Yeah, where do you even start
interesting
with
article, those? Interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, which is not known for its sports coverage, and maybe this is indicative of the fact of why it's not known for its sports coverage, but the author was writing about the fact that punting is dropping off to an all-time low in the National Football League. And this guy said, are we going to move to a point where punting is going to become rare? Because A, teams are getting better and the whole risk assessment of going for it on fourth down has changed.
Well, the tush push has a lot to do with it.
Well, that's part of it. B, the field goal is becoming reachable from 60 yards now. And so you don't even need to be on the other guy. You'd only need to be just a few yards into the other guy's side of the field before you've got a guy who can kick the.
All right, hang on that one for a second. What have they done different with the balls that all of a sudden are allowing these guys to go 10 yards further? Something different that the field goal guy gets to pull it out and push it. Keep pushing on it the whole game, or something, or getting to soften it up, or something has changed on the ball they kick the field goal with.
All the footballs get inspected before they're used in a game. So they have a supply of balls that have all passed muster for pressure and everything else. That was the whole Deflategate issue. And I don't think they're doing anything specific with
the
balls.
I think something about Jimmy, once you looked at it, I think somehow how the kickers get to select a couple of balls and do something with them for kicking or something like that.
I'll just tell you that compressing footballs has been going on forever.
Let's not dwell on it, but in the back of my feeble brain, something happened in the last couple of years that changed the way the balls are the balls that the kickers use, how they're kept or something during the game. Something's changed.
What I'm seeing in training facilities everywhere is that the kicking game and field goal kicking has become a much more scientific and studied kind of process.
Plus, it's also not on grass.
In, Well, actually, it is on grass. In most cases. I mean, most of the league stadiums are natural grass because of the injury issues. Kicking is become very, very specialized. The you know, how you strike the ball, the angle, the foot speed, the way the holder positions it, all of this has been reduced now to study, you know, efficient motion analysis, and I think there's just a lot more thoughtfulness going into that process. I mean, when you and I were watching football as kids, any kick over 50 yards was remarkable. Now, those were guys were used, those were straight-on kickers. They weren't soccer style. But even when soccer style started coming, you know, into vogue in the 70s, you know, and into the 80s, you weren't, a 50-yard field goal was something, you know, you were punting unless you had like a gale blowing behind you when you were kicking. Now, the 50-plus yard field goal, I mean, it's not a gimme, but it's certainly makeable for most of the kickers that I'm seeing. And what was the walk-off 55-yard?
Here's your AI. NFL kickers now must use footballs that are prepped and softened beforehand, as teams are allowed to break in their kick balls in advance of game day to improve kicking range and consistency. This rule change, which became permanent in the 2025 season, allows for better control of the leather and seams on the kicking balls, reducing resistance and adding distance to kicks.
Okay.
What about being indoors now? I mean, before, when you're outdoors, 50-yarder is pretty tough. I mean, even in Chicago with the wind, that's pretty tough. I think the thing is, gentlemen, that they've gotten better. I would agree with Lou, better at a little bit on the science, but being a European football fan, I could tell you that the goalie can normally kick there on a free kick 60 to 70 yards.
Yep.
Easy. And they've been doing it for years.
All right, guys, since you asked, advanced preparation. Teams can now prepare their kicking footballs, K-balls, well in advance of a game rather than needing to prepare them on game day. This preparation includes softening the leather and scraping the nubs or dimples to reduce air resistance, which helps the ball travel further and makes it easier to compress off the seams. The goal of the rule change is to provide a more consistent, reliable kicking ball, which can add a few yards at a kicker's range and improve their ability to control the ball's flight. There you go.
Okay. Well, I was unaware that they were allowed to scrape the dimples.
I didn't know that either. But now we know.
That's an interesting change.
What's funny, Lou, is whenever you say.
But so the punt becomes, you know, the punt is not your first choice anymore.
For the Bears, it's usually their most valuable player.
So you're not jumping on the bandwagon after one good game by your team.
I got them winning four games. That was one of them.
Okay,
the one this week's another one. By the way, I think they could.
Yeah. Anyway, the punt that I was looking at that, and you know, there are college. I'm trying to remember, it was either a college or a high school team. I think it was a small college team where they just don't punt. They go for it on fourth down every time.
Well, you know, your AI stat dudes now say that you should always go for it pretty much on fourth down.
That's right. You and I have had that. We had a long discussion one episode about how coaches look at trend analysis, and you know, the idea that, you know, if you do it consistently, you end up with certain results. But of course, the coaches don't do it consistently because they're constantly assessing the specifics of each play. But I was fascinated when I first read that there were teams that went for it on fourth down regardless of the down and distance, just because, you know, taking that off the table statistically indicated that they were generally correct in doing so. The problem is, of course, you're going to get second guessed every time if you go for it on fourth and eight on your 20 yard line.
Help me with this, because there was a coach they interviewed when this stuff first came out. You know, the money ball kind of thing for football, and they say you should always go for it, like on fourth and one, fourth and two. The odds are in your favor. And then one coach, I forget, it was a college or high, a pro coach, he goes, "The odds might be in my favor, but if my guard can't block their tackle, Mm-hmm. It's a problem or something along those lines. I can't just go by what's on the score sheet here. My guy has to go do it.
Over the course of a season, the odds might be in my favor.
Yeah.
But when I've got a rookie tackle going against an all-pro defensive end on this particular play and this particular game, because I mean, my father used to talk about this because he was an early adapter of computerized analysis for play calling and trend analysis. I mean, it was really something. We had a conversation with one of the old Viking IT guys who said that he had in the late 70s he had gone and said, I want printouts. I want you to start putting, game and results into the computer, and let's get a program to pull this together. But what he said was, the averaging over the course of a season doesn't take into account the fact that 10 or 20 of those results, which in a 16-game season can be fairly significant, 10 or 20 of those results came against terrible football teams. Or really good football teams. And so you can never ignore the quality of the opponent and who you're going against in that weather, on that stadium, on that particular day. And well, you have to do it. He goes,
guy used to trade for me. Well, he worked for me. Tom Tracy was a basketball player at DePaul and got drafted by the Celtics, but then he had to go in the Army. So by the time he got out, he didn't make the Celtics. Anyway, but the story was, back before they had these camps that everybody pays a bunch for, he goes to this basketball camp, right? And some guy gets in there, and he's got this huge blackboard, when they had blackboards, and he's diagramming all these plays. X is here, O is there, and everybody's done all these plays. And some good old boy walks in after another coach. He goes, boys, let me tell you, this is all well and good, but what really matters is who are the X's and who are the O's.
Exactly.
And, what's interesting?
Nick Saban. Nick Saban. When we hit a crisis situation in a game, I don't look at the playbook. I look at the player.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what I found different in my years of watching this stuff, when I first started watching, you had guys like Eric Parseghian, who I think were spectacular coaches. But the college game, they thought the special teams play was kind of an add-on, where, the punter, you asked everybody that you recruited, hey, can any of you guys punt, basically. And maybe the kicker, if you didn't have somebody, you got somebody off the soccer team. And the one thing I noticed is guys who came back to college, even if they weren't that good of a coach, like Dan Devine and Lou Holtz, had an incredibly different view of special teams play than guys who were always in college. To them, games are won and lost in the special teams. The old college coaches didn't necessarily feel that way.
So when you – I think that's right. But when you look at an effective special teams operation, like with Devin Hester,
yeah,
when the Bears had Devin Hester,
or Rackett Ishmael,
Hester was consistently good for 100 plus yards of offense.
Yeah,
he could move the ball from where it was punted or kicked off. You were guaranteed an extra 100 yards of ball, advancement every game by virtue of what he did. And I thought somebody's got to be looking at these numbers, because this kid is that's game changer.
Yeah.
And so I always
that was Gale Sayers-esque, basically.
Yes, I remember. Well, I think I was watching the Vikings one time in the 70s, and kickoffs were just, to me in high school, were just random events. You ran downfield, you turned around, if you're on the receiving team, you ran downfield toward the ball, you turned around, and then you looked for somebody. You had a rough idea of somebody within your zone that you could reach and hit and knock down. But the return guy was supposed to just sort of keep an eye out for where the break was going to come in the coverage and try to slot his way in there. And I remember watching a game and watching the Vikings, and I see two Vikings go after one guy on the kickoff team in the middle. They did wedges. They would do the wedge block where you'd get four or five guys lined up in front of the return man, and then you would try to run the wedge through and force your
was that as dumb as I thought team. It was I think it was
It was very dangerous.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous play. But I watched these two Viking return guys come out and literally target one guy and block him and drive him like 8 yards in one direction. And actually they knocked down like two or three guys when they did that. And I told my father, I said, "Do you know that these guys are double teaming?" He goes, "Oh yeah, that's part of our plan." And I said, You literally planned this?" He said, "Yep. You'll see if you watch our special teams coverage," and this was in late 70s, I think. He said, "If you watch our special teams coverage, you'll see there's two or three guys that are designated as people that are going to get double teamed and swept out of the way, because that's the easiest way to make a scene in the return coverage." And I was gone. I thought, that's amazing. I never thought of doing that. I always thought it was just, yeah, pick somebody and knock them down. That's not. And if you watch returns now, you see a very definite dance forming as the ball goes, depending on where it's going and depending on how people are setting up. And it used to be basic, return right, return left, return center. And so you had a rough idea where the ball was going, and you try to take your man away from that direction. It's a much more complex movement pattern out there.
Well,
now,
do you have any, Kevin just texted, do we have any, this, I mean, I'm watching the Cubs basically fall apart, and I'm watching, what is going on with the Tigers? They had the best record in baseball. Now they're one game away from not even making a wild card. They've lost like how many games in a row? A couple of times. They're the best team in baseball. They have people hurt or what?
I have not. I knew Detroit was good just at the beginning of the year. I don't know. I haven't heard any explanation.
They were
about
far and away the best record in baseball, two thirds of the season, and now they can't win a game. What are they? Their last 30 games. I mean, they got to be like 5-25 or something. Maybe it's not that bad, but close.
Psychology.
Yeah, you wonder if there's little nagging injuries. I mean, the Cubs are going through that, and you wonder when the fans get at people. They got this guy, Asian guy, Seau. The dude had like 20 some home runs for the All Star break. He was leading. I think he was leading the league in RBIs since the All Star break. He's got like one or two home runs, hitting 160. You can't tell me these guys aren't hurt. I mean, You can get cold, but you can't get that cold. I mean, there must be something nagging injuries to people that they just keep playing or don't tell somebody or what. What do you think? I mean, how can you be that good and be that crummy?
I don't know, but every other season or so, there's some baseball team. It seems because they play so many games, it's much more obvious. There's some baseball team that goes into an epic collapse, and it's of course out here in Denver. The epic collapse starts about two or three games into the season, and it just continues. But you get good teams who suddenly find themselves unable to win, and all the great coaches from Lombardi to the Dodgers guy to whoever, they all talk about the winning being a mentality. And developing a winning mentality. And I always have always wondered, even for pros, even for guys that are doing this for a living, the psychology of being on a winning organization where the ball seems to bounce right for you and you've got guys making great efforts and it always works, there's got to be a psychological element there that causes you to be a better or to play better, take more risks, do more interesting things. I don't know.
Well, I think there's some of it, though, you can get behind. It's sort of specialized. But the one year, was it 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Jimmy, where the Cubs started the season with a closer. They stuck with him, the first 20 games. My numbers might be a little off, but they blew like 8 saves, like in the first 25 games. They were so far back. Then it turns out the guy needed surgery. And they never came back from that. They just never. It took them a while to find another closer, or a couple of your starters go down, or a couple of guys that are key to go down. It's The difference is dramatic. You know what I wonder?
So here's the AI overview, since we've been talking about AI. The Detroit Tigers are collapsing due to an 8-game losing streak in September, fueled by a struggling offense, a depleted bullpen, and key player mistakes, all while the Cleveland Guardians made an incredible 18-5 run to overtake them for the AL Central lead. The Tigers have underperformed their expected run differential, failing to capitalize on opportunities and making costly errors at crucial points.
Well, you know, did you watch the Monday night game last week where the Detroit beat the Ravens?
Yes, I did.
Did you happen to watch the first game where they got their ass kicked by Green Bay?
Yeah. Or at least I saw the highlights of the game.
Well,
yeah.
if you
two different football teams.
Well, if you watch the game, and I don't normally, but I was at home, so I'm listening to it. I wasn't anywhere else. And listen to Tony Romo, and I actually have a pretty fair opinion of that guy.
He's good.
And evidently what happened, the Detroit center retired surprisingly, and I won't say shockingly, but they didn't expect. They thought he was going to play another year or two, so he retires. He's all pro. One of the guards, I guess, they lost to free agency or something. And so they basically are getting drilled in the middle of the line by the Packers, who happen to have a pretty good defensive line. And Tony Romo says, don't count these guys out. I mean, they lost a couple people there. He said, but the guys they put in there, I don't know if he said they were really good draft picks or something, because they're young guys. They're players. They're going to be okay. He goes, this team, mid-season, the interior of the line is not going to be a problem. And all of a sudden, I'm watching him play the Ravens, and whoever was the color guy, he goes, do you believe how well these two guards are playing only after their fourth game or something? He goes, these guys are moving people around. They're controlling the line of scrimmage. These are the same guys that Tony Romo said, give them a couple of games, will you?
Well, and you've heard me say this before. Offensive line play, excuse me, offensive line play is a dance. It's a ballet except the dancers are 300 pounds.
Yeah.
And they're dancing against other people who are trying to stop them from doing their dance moves. But it is a ballet of synchronized movement. And the fact that you can't hit at full speed in practices now, except for very limited circumstances, means that the full speed hitting, and that's how you have to synchronize your movements. You only synchronize them at full speed. Full speed hitting, which allows you to synchronize your movements, only takes place in the games. And so it takes a while to get that synchronization down. Not to mention the fact that the center is the guy that's calling the blocking patterns for everybody. So when he sets up, he's the guy who looks up and says, okay, we're blocking this way, we're blocking whatever. So it takes a while for that guy to get his head into the into the mix. But I was boy, they just, I mean, what did they have? 250 yards of rushing?
Yeah, with the guy against,
the Raven defense is pretty good.
Yeah, with the guy the Bears didn't want, Montgomery, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Well, again, goes back to, everything starts with the offensive line, and a good offensive line can make an average running back look like, OJ.
Well, I want to run this by you on the portal stuff, because we only got a couple minutes. The Irish lost their first two games. The second game, they should not have lost, because that was the most ridiculous non-call I ever saw when the guy tackled the dude. But let's say, one way or the other, the Irish are still, probably to a greater extent than most, are going with the old model. Getting people out of high. It's not that they don't have people through the portal. They do. They're just as dirty, maybe as all these other teams. Maybe not quite, but they're still trying to go through the old way of doing things, recruiting offensive linemen and stuff out of high school and blah, blah, blah. And I have a feeling that their offensive line, which hasn't shown too well, by mid-year is going to be really good, because they get these really good kids out of high school. And I was just wondering, Lou, if that's going to be your style going forward, and you're going to try and stick with old plan, you got to find a way to not schedule your two toughest teams the first two games of the year.
I agree.
But I don't know how you do that. I mean, because...
I mean, this is, and I don't want to extend my time here. I did too much last week. This is the Duke model in basketball. But in basketball, you're playing so many games that you can recover from a couple of early season losses. Duke schedules very difficult teams early on in their basketball program. They have for decades as part of the, we're going to toughen up right away. it's harder to get away with that in football because you're just not playing enough games.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the somehow or another, the media, you know, I don't want to go ranting and raving about the Lightning game on Saturday, but it's really scary, Lou, that no matter what, they were calling commercials in the second half, and then all of a sudden they got booted off national TV. It took so long. I mean, doesn't anybody have a brain cell working or what?
Dollars drives all of that. You know that.
Yeah, well, it's... Anyway, what do you get? So the earliest these places can open is when? Like Thanksgiving? Or what? Loveland's always the first, right? Are they, what are they, like?
They've set opening days already. And if I had immediate access to Grok, I would ask it that question. I think they're going to be opening in early November.
But don't people go up to Loveland just because they're always the first, and then as soon as the other places open, nobody goes to Loveland?
Yes, because Loveland's a small, difficult ski area with not much around it. A Basin is the other one that opens up early.
Did you ever ski? I went by it 10 times as I drove to Steamboat. Did you ever ski at Winter Park? That always looked like the tundra of northern Alaska or something. I never had any. It's, you're so high up. It's so windy.
It was never a place I wanted to go to, because most of my ski trips tended to be day trips from either here or our house, and it was too hard to get to.
Plus the places you stay are like a mile down the road. You always see people hitchhiking and stuff. I'm saying, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, it's I mean if you're going to go up, it was a place, if you were going to go up there, you wanted to go up there for like a week.
So, wow. You must get some really awful weather over the course of that week, boy. I mean, you're up there.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I know.
The reason you want to stay up there a week, you don't want to be up there and have to come back down and be in a position where you've got to be back down by a specific time.
No, that pass closes all the time.
That's right.
All right, but take care of yourself. SP Futures down 25, NASDAQ Futures down 135. Jimmy, do we have our guys?
Yes, we do, but we do need to go to break.
All right, let's go to break real quick.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
We're back.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom, Jim Lohr on the board. SP Futures down 25. NASDAQ Futures down 133. At the bottom of the hour, we'll do our huge spin through everything, and Jimmy will give us our sports report. But if this Detroit doesn't make the playoffs, it's got to be as big a collapse ever, isn't it, Jimmy?
Not really. The Cubs still hold that in 1969. Detroit is only one game back. There are four to go.
Don't forget, 69, the Mets were what? 28-2 or something?
But still, the Cubs lost. Were 20 games going into September and lost.
Ah. I think that more the Mets won than the Cubs lost. But it took two to tango. The Mets
wouldn't
have won.
I will say this. Someone was wearing a black hat walking around Wrigley Field.
Ah.
As you know, the famous black cat that went into the...
I was watching that game, believe it or not.
Into the batter's circle during the game at Shea Stadium.
The beloved Shea Stadium, Nat. Do we have our guys?
Yes, we do.
Andrew, Wayne, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I bet you guys can't find a topic to talk about this week.
No, the news has been so dead.
Yeah.
I mean.
We had the I'm kind of jousting with one of my guests. We had the guy shot by the ICE person here, right?
Yeah.
And I was kind of saying, look, this is not, and one reason why I get this point of view is one of my best friends was in the National Guard for the 68 convention, right? And he goes, we weren't trained for that. We're surely not trained to do traffic stops. We're not trained to arrest people. That's not what we do. It's a bad idea. And you know, from being a guy like that, I value his opinion. I'm sure this guy, trying to do a traffic stop on a guy, they don't have body cams like police do. There's no civilian review board that I know of. I don't know who the hell you sue. Who do you sue? The White House? I mean, I have no idea. So all of a sudden, they pull this guy over. Now, whether they got him by his license plates or whatever, the dude, my one person talking about it, kind of panics and tries to back his way out. Well, the original story was that he like ran over the guy, and the guy's got two broken legs. Well, it turns out that when the state police showed up, they interviewed the ICE guy with a body cam, and he goes, "Nah, I just got a scrape." So he's not in the hospital. He doesn't have two broken legs. Well, he shoots the guy dead. And now, so now, there's no real body cam. There's no real witnesses of any kind, except for the fact that the guy's dead and one guy's got a bruised knee. I'm not saying the guy didn't try to do something crazy. I'm not, but the fact is, we don't have the body cams and stuff that we demand other people have. The guys are wearing masks. Not that that makes that much of a difference. And yet, people defend one side and the other side. The fact is, nobody knows, and now everybody else, every one of these times police interact with people, people are supposed to know. That's why you want the body cams and stuff. And all of a sudden, these guys don't have to do that. I just have a problem with that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. All I know is once somebody's dead, and the whatever crime the guy may have committed, you know, the penalty was not life. And yeah, people defend the hell out of it. I just don't get that.
I think there was a movie you may have seen years ago called Judge Dredd with Sylvester Stallone. Anyway, he was like judge, jury, and executioner all at one time.
sounds like Judge Roy Bean, right?
Exactly. This incident in Dallas, I mean, you get Cash Patel and Trump. It was Antifa. It was this. Here's another case like that Charlie Kirk shooter. These people do this don't fit into some nice little prearranged criteria. This guy in Dallas who killed himself apparently was a denizen of the 4chan platform. Now that attracts a lot of wackos there. That's
okay.
That's
well, like, who's that?
Well, 4chan is, you know, a lot of gamers, but a lot of what they call dark web activities too. And they said he didn't like Trump, but apparently he liked Ron Paul. So that puts him in the libertarian category, which, you know, you can't pin Ron Paul on the Democrats. He, his son, of course, is the senator from Kentucky.
Why do we have to pin him into one group or another? Anybody who shoots somebody is just nuts.
Yeah. Well, it fits into a criteria that the White House wants to, basically use this as a cudgel to go after, you know, what they call communists, leftists, Democrats, trade unions, and everything else. We've seen this. By the way, we saw this movie once before in the 1930s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. what are they arresting Comey for? I haven't kept up with that.
Andy might have a little more on that, but apparently, remember when Trump called Comey when he was FBI director into the White House?
Yeah.
And said, look, you know, I hope you're on my side. Can you drop this investigation on Mike Flynn, blah, blah, blah. Well, then in 2000, he was, in 2020, I should say, he was before a Senate committee, and he was asked by Ted Cruz, I think it was, whether he leaked any of that information about his meeting with Trump. And I guess it was in 2017, early 2017, after the inauguration, if he leaked that to the media. And he said, absolutely, I did not. So now the statute of limitations, because this happened in 2017, it expires on Tuesday next week. So they're trying to get, you know, the guy who refused to prosecute Comey, this guy Siebert, he resigned. He said there's no case against him or New York Attorney General Letitia James. And so then Trump put one of his lady friends, who I guess was a runner-up, Miss Colorado, put her in, and she's apparently going in, you know, planning to indict Comey. But apparently it hasn't even gone to a grand jury yet. So that's another hurdle they got, you know, in the Eastern District of Virginia. That's a very liberal part of the state. And here's the other interesting aspect a lot of people don't know.
Oh, does federal stuff have a grand jury?
Yeah, this is federal. This is Eastern District of Virginia.
But it's not,
and Alexandria. The guy who resigned, who was a Trump appointee, he's the son-in-law of the Republican governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin.
The reason why I ask, you guys always bring up stuff that I'm sort of thinking about anyway. Does the federal system, they're not called grand juries, because the kid upstairs from me, the kid, he's younger than me, he's got called for federal jury duty, and he's got to go for like 6 weeks, and it's like a grand jury, but it's not really a grand jury. The grand jury is county, right? I mean, how does that actually work? I guess is my question. Maybe
okay. Andy's a lawyer. He'll take this from here.
Well, typically there might be two sets of jurors. One is a trial jury, and the other is a grand jury. So the grand jury only hears from the prosecution.
Are we talking about state or federal or both?
Actually, both, although states have varied procedures. So let's stick to federal. It's basically similar, but states can have special grand juries that are kind of state by state situation. But a grand jury basically meets for a long time, and multiple weeks, and they hear all kinds of cases, and the prosecutors, usually it's a rubber stamp type thing, and the prosecutors come in and they have a whole laundry list of suspects, and they run through what their evidence is, and the grand jury usually almost always indicts, because they only hear one side, and it takes only a preponderance, most of the grand jurors, to get an indictment. And you normally need a grand jury for a felony charge. The other type of jury is, you know, what most listeners above a certain age have probably been part of that process. You're called in, you sit in a room, and you might be picked for a trial. And if you're not picked, you go back to the room and wait for the next trial to come up. And on those cases, it can be either civil or criminal. If it's a criminal case, it takes guilt beyond a reasonable doubt by all of the jurors. Now, if we're applying this to the situation that Wayne was talking about, great concise summary, by the way. If they try to get this indictment in Alexandria, which is right across the river from Washington, and a lot of federal employees live there, well, they're going to have two problems. One, in Washington, D.C., a number of grand juries have recently just refused to indict who Trump wants indicted, including famously Chief, I don't know if you saw it, but did you see this guy during the deployment of the National Guard who threw a Subway sandwich?
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah, I didn't see the video of the sandwich in the air, but
yeah. Well, it was, some of us have watched it.
Well, it was a couple of days old. It might be a lethal weapon.
Well, at any rate, he goes running off, and they chase him. He's kind of a heavyset guy who actually I think was a paralegal working for the federal government.
DOJ, right?
DOJ. So the acting attorney general, the former Fox host Jean Pirro, she makes a huge thing on TV. We're going to get this guy.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
And the grand jury twice refused to indict him. Well, they may face a problem like that with Comey unless they move it to a red area, you know, in the south of Virginia. But even more so, they're going to have a problem at trial because, for one thing, Comey, former FBI director, former deputy head of the Justice Department, he's going to have good lawyers. And you're going to have, and I've covered cases.
Well, how does Comey have the money to pay those kinds of lawyers to fight this? Nobody does.
Well, that's a problem because...
And that's what Trump is hoping for. Trump just wants to see the perp walk. He doesn't care what happens after that. So with Letitia James and Comey and John Bolton, he wants to see them handcuffed and taken in, arraigned, indicted, all that.
Well, there's two people in a room and something leaked. Who the hell believes Trump? It has any...
I mean, Andy was mentioning Jeanine Pirro. Well, here's one prosecutor that was not able to indict a ham sandwich.
Yeah, but just quickly on this thing, yeah, there's a lot of issues. It's going to cost a lot of money. The purpose is to ruin the defendant and their family, because minimum the defendant has to pay at least $100,000 just to be basic defense. And the concept is the U.S. taxpayer paid Justice Department has unlimited resources. They can sometimes, I've covered cases where the Justice Department has spent millions upon millions of dollars to go after people and can't even get a conviction.
Try Blagojevich the first time through.
Pardon me?
Blagojevich the first time through. But I mean, just in terms of, I know this is maybe not in the realms of legal. Let me get this straight. There's two people in a room, they have a private conversation. Something gets leaked. One guy is accused of it, and you can't call the other guy to testify. What is wrong with this picture?
Well, here's what, I'm not totally sure, because, of course, at this stage of an investigation, things are secret by law, except what Trump and these people are leaking out themselves.
You just said it, except what Trump is leaking.
but here's what may be the fine point, and let's take almost everybody has done something that they're not proud of, or you see that's part of the system. It's very rare that somebody is totally innocent, and that's why the technical legal term is not guilty. It doesn't mean totally innocent. Now in Comey's case, as Wayne has recounted, what we know of or think we know about this, he said, "No, I didn't leak anything." Now, what he may have done though is work with a friend of his who was a law professor, and the law professor leaked it. So that's if that's what this is about. then the jury is going to look at this, and depending on maybe their politics, if they can't put their politics aside, they're going to say, well, technically, he didn't leak it. The law professor did. But if you're more, you want to see the guy convicted, you'd say, well, he didn't leak it, but that's close enough because his friend leaked it. So that could be 2 years from now what the case comes down to, millions of dollars down the road. But in the meantime...
And how many leakages from Trump between now and then? A million?
Well, in the meantime, there will be mugshots of Comey if the grand jury goes forward. But there will be, Trump able to say, look, we've got this guy, and when he's likely acquitted, and the judge may even throw it out. Wayne and I have covered cases in that courthouse where sometimes even, quote, very conservative justices or judges will take a look at things and just say, get this case out of here, case dismissed before trial.
And with the risk of having my phone light up here, the message to me, and I'm, I don't know how I turned into this as I age. We have people on the show that are kind of on the other side of some of this stuff, and they dig into the detail correctly. And now you're, to a certain extent, being the attorney that you are, you're digging into the detail as well, which is, by the way, the question I asked you, so thank you for that. But the message is to everybody else, this guy will leave no stone unturned to screw with you if you go against him. It doesn't matter what position you are, judge, head of the FBI, whatever it is, doesn't care whether it's right or wrong. He's going to make your life miserable if you don't go down the road with him. And if people on both sides don't understand that's the message, I can't help them.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You look at the Kimmel situation. He basically, after Kimmel's show came back on, he basically admitted that he was the guy who had who put the pressure on ABC to have Kimmel fired in one of these tweets that he sends out. It's like if back during Watergate, Nixon was communicating all the things he was charged with. He was just putting I'll tell you the Washington Post, put me on the networks. I'll tell everybody about the laws I'm breaking. I mean, this is what Trump is essentially doing.
People who like him, doesn't matter what he does. Absolutely doesn't matter what he does. I just wonder what. And by the way, a lot of what the dude says is not wrong. I mean, not like he doesn't have some street smarts. It's not like, I mean, everybody on the liberal side was bashing his United Nations sort of thing. And I was discussing this with a couple people that are fairly liberal. I said, okay, the guy acted like a buffoon in some ways, but the fact is, he's right. In the last 10 wars, what exactly has the United Nations done? I've not heard of one trip from the guy who's the head of the United Nations out to, Zimbabwe, wherever the hell there's a war, and coming back with a peace or any kind of settlement.
You're right. I covered two of those General Assembly, what they call plenary sessions. This is where all they're always in September. They always bring all the heads of state, heads of government. And back, I think it was 2010 or 2009, I covered one guy who was speaking to the United Nations, and he took a copy of the UN Charter and tore it up into pieces and threw it up in the air. Now, people who love the UN were appalled by that, but, a lot of the delegations who, didn't think the UN was doing anything for them, mostly in the third world, they were up and applauding what he did. The guy that did that was Gaddafi of Libya. Yeah. And he was getting high. he was getting high-fived on his way out of the General Assembly.
Well, I mean, even if you don't like somebody's general demeanor, it doesn't mean they're always wrong.
Right. Right.
Well, here's let me take a somewhat contrary view, Chief. On the big picture, what we don't know is what we don't know. So the United Nations was formed after there were two world wars that killed, total...
Oh, God.
80 million people.
I'm going to say at least. There was like 20 million in Russia in one spot, right?
Yeah, we haven't had that. So, yeah, we can find innumerable flaws, and all of us here on the call have done that in our minds and more publicly. But what we haven't had since the formation of the United Nations is world wars.
I agree.
Now we're getting close to it, though, with the breakdown in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so just yesterday, Trump, as part of his speech, it wasn't Trump, it was the European Union, saying that they might shoot down Russian planes because Russia is now flying over Poland, Estonia, testing the limits of NATO. And so if you look on NATO and United Nations as important institutions created after World War II by the United States largely, without those, do we really want to go back to might makes right and every?
Oh, I absolutely do not. I hope you're not. As you know, I think you know, or you wouldn't be on the show. I'm trying to drag information out of you guys, and you guys are closer to this. But if I were to ask, we're going to break here in a minute. If I were to ask, what do they do all day? I think you have a problem answering that question.
No, I would agree, and in fact, I've even said, I forget whether publicly or privately, there's a certain bureaucracy mentality at the United Nations that's very objectionable, and so you're absolutely right about that. But here's one just factual matter, and maybe you guys can correct me.
Well, and once you answer me this, keep that till after the break, and then think about this one. Is it their purview, or should they, if a war breaks out, there always seems to be one or two in Africa, and that's not disparaging anybody, is it their purview, their responsibility for the head of the UN and a couple guys going out there and say, hey, can we help stop this? I haven't seen that happen in 30 years. I mean, I don't know if they should or shouldn't or what their charter.
Well, they have peacekeeping forces. We can talk about it after.
Yeah, because I'm kind of curious after this blows up. If you don't like Trump, you say, okay, I could like it before. Well, you know what? He's still our president, and when he's right, I don't mind saying he's right. I'm kind of a thing. SP Futures up down 23, NASDAQ Futures down 127. Be right back.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. We're back.
Lowing up big stocks and jocks. I'm Tom Howe. He's Jim Lawler on board. SP Futures down 25. NASDAQ Futures down 134. Just a real quick spin around the rest of the world here. DAX down 259. It's 1.1%. FTSE down 33. Not so much. 0.4%. CAC around down 60.7. The euro. A European med tech firm slide after U.S. opens probe into medical device imports. We'll see where that goes. Nikkei up 124.3%. Hang Seng down 33. Call that flat. Shanghai down 34 cents. Let's really call that one flat. Oil down 50 cents, 64.49. So it's well above the 63, but not quite a breakout yet. We've got gold up 1870, but still under 3800, 3786, but a little bit of a bounce. Silver rubber's up a buck, Chuck, 45.21. Jimmy, you want to do a real quick sports, or we're just going to right back to our guys?
Sure. Well, as we know, the Cubs did beat the Mets 10-3. The Dodgers beat the Diamondbacks 4-5, and the White Sox unfortunately lost to the Yankees. Right now, the Yankees are tied with the Toronto Blue Jays for the top of that division. Also tonight, we have the Seahawks versus the Phoenix Cardinals. Back to you, Chief.
Tonight doesn't exist because I can't get it.
Unfortunately, it does for the people who have Prime.
All right. Well, so yeah, I mean, Andrew, get back on this. I mean, I'm not, you know, beating. I have a little bit of a history on this. I have a good friend who has this, anyway, some kind of mathematical system, and the UN found her, and they ended up giving her a UN passport. They're pretty cool. They're like a light purple. They're pretty nice looking. And she was doing some work with a couple of these places in Africa, and she said they were so in bed with the dictators, where they, you know, of course you got to pay the dictator off to get anything done. So they were sort of doing that. And she just said, she gave them the passport back and said, I want no part of it. I mean, I know the people they deal with worldwide are so corrupt that you end up sort of in the same bed with the fleas on you. But I mean, I just, at the end of the day, I mean, the stuff that Trump says he does, you know, I stopped this war, and maybe he did, and God knows where, a place I didn't even know there was a war. Is that their job, or isn't it? I don't even know anymore, do you?
Well, here's two things. And Wayne has actually done a lot of work in this area, so I'll be handing it off quickly here. But on the one level, when you think about it, in terms of peacekeeping, they do a lot of that, but obviously with smaller countries like Haiti. So what they might do is get an African country to come in and try to stop just total chaos, horrible situations. And they can do that with a small country, even a violent. It doesn't work that well because it's so bad down there in Haiti.
Yeah, what is there? Is there a fix for
Haiti? But it's better than it would be if the UN didn't have people coming in. But obviously, the UN can't go into a situation like Gaza or Russia or Ukraine, and that's what, because those are the big boys. It's just not feasible. So that's a realistic restraint on what they can do, but it's also why the U.S. fostered alliances, including NATO, to try to handle the big stuff and to stop, let's say, a bombing of Poland or Estonia or places like that, if it might happen. But here's on a micro, that's a macro level. Here's a micro level that people are getting a lot of misinformation. So let's take this speech a big part of what was supposed to be a 15-minute speech but turned into more than 45 minutes of Trump was he was complaining that the escalator stopped while he was going up.
Oh, yeah, I read about that.
He complained that the teleprompter didn't work. And
maybe, it was a 15-minute teleprompter. He talked for 45 minutes.
Yeah, well, it came back on, and then he said, you know, we pay 22% of the dues here, and then the White House press secretary amplified all of that into basically, if they don't find out who ruined the teleprompter and who stopped the escalator, we should quit the UN. And so this is going out from the White House to all the media. It's amplified on the media. And people are thinking, what the hell is the matter with the UN? They screwed up his escalator, his teleprompter, and we're paying 22%. And let me hand that over to Wayne.
Well, the thing is, we're assessed at 22%, but we're in arrears on our dues. We're the only permanent member. There's five of them. There's us. Russia, formerly was the Soviet Union, had that permanent seat. France, UK, and China. And we're the only permanent member that hasn't paid its dues. We didn't during Trump's first term. He stopped paying dues. Biden started paying the dues again, and then when Trump gets back in, so there's a budget shortfall at the UN when you're assessed at 22%.
Wayne, wasn't there somebody
that money?
There was somebody before Trump that didn't pay too. Is it Obama? We were in arrears a while back too, weren't we?
This might have been during W. Bush.
Okay.
And it might have had something to do with the UN was not, you know, supporting this operation against Saddam Hussein, although the UN was very much in favor of the Afghanistan thing. But I once interviewed then former Secretary General Boutros Ghali in Paris.
That was one hell of a name to say every night, wasn't it?
Yeah. real nice guy, Egyptian diplomat. A lot of people didn't like his policy on Israel, which secretary generals really don't have. Secretary generals don't have policies, but his wife was an Egyptian Jewish woman, but they were accusing him of all kinds of anti-Israel bias and stuff like that. But anyway, he told me, he said, look, the problem with the UN is that it relies on its members to do things. Now, during the Cold War, there would be no peacekeeping operations unless they were agreed to by the United States and the Soviet Union. If those two parties did not agree on anything, then the UN was a debating society, which was one of the criticisms of the UN back in the day.
Wasn't the Korean War done because the Russian guy stomped out?
That was an interesting bypass. So what happened is the Russian, the Soviet delegate was vetoing any move into Korea by the UN. And so what happened is there was the United States and other countries went to the General Assembly and did something called a United for Peace resolution, which then turned it back to the Security Council minus the Soviet delegate, and they agreed, of course, to send in a UN peacekeeping force into Korea. And in those days, of course, the Chinese seat was held by the nationalist government on Taiwan. So there was no other problems with potential vetoes like there is now. Although the United States has vetoed a lot more resolutions at the Security Council than Russia or China has, especially in the Middle East.
Taiwan was never on there, wasn't it, Formosa?
No, the UN continued to recognize the Republic of China, which was Chiang Kai-shek's government,
right.
Even though they had escaped to Taiwan, they recognized it up until 1971 when they turned.
I remember the night they booted, they actually booted them out on like national TV, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, they had held this vote. To have it wasn't to admit the mainland China, it was just to turn over the seat. and very ignominiously the Taiwan delegates had to get up and leave, and it was, you know,
it was kind of weird the way they did it. Yeah, you guys go, and the other guys came in and sat down, right?
Yeah, essentially, that's what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't write history like this. You wouldn't sell a book. I mean, you wouldn't write fiction like this. You wouldn't sell a book. So the we're sort of in arrears, and I thought Obama was in arrears. We've not paid our bill there is quite a ways for the last 20 years.
If Obama was, it was probably something done by when the Republicans held the Senate or the House. They of course have the purse strings, and it could have been some move there to withhold dues. You may be right on that, but Obama was a big supporter of the UN. After all, people don't know this, but Obama's first job out of law school was working for this Business International Corporation, which was located at 1 Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, UN Plaza in Manhattan. And later it was discovered that this firm was really a CIA front.
Well, my academic mind always has to ask these stupid questions. Out of 100% of the money that the UN spends, they got to spend a chunk of it there, don't they? Here?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the just to maintain that headquarters building is a lot of money. And you heard one of the things Trump was upset about was his company didn't get a contract to redo the UN headquarters. It went to, I guess, one of his competitors, and he said, "Yeah, they use cheap marble lookalike. I would have used real marble." And you know, I mean, it's
we think Trump has an escalator repair company or what?
Let me hop in here for a second. One, even though Wayne has written a book about this topic and innumerable articles, Wayne, I think you misspoke. It wasn't his first job out of law school. It was his first job out of undergrad.
Oh, out of undergrad, okay.
Wayne's literally written the book on this. Just to correct
Occidental.
That.
Yeah.
No, Columbia, I think.
And then he went to Columbia,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Wayne, talk about the escalator and the teleprompter.
The UN's getting a bum rap for this. Apparently, he had a videographer. His guy was on the escalator in front of him, standing there backwards, getting a shot of a Trump and his wife coming up, and his bag or his foot or some piece of equipment hit that emergency stop button, and that's what caused the escalator to stop. And during speeches by world leaders, they turned the teleprompter over to their staff members. So it was a member of Trump's staff that was operating the teleprompter when it froze.
But most of America, coming from the White House press secretary and amplified innumerable times on social media, TV, they're blaming a nefarious plot on the UN for what is apparently an internal staff.
And this dude on Fox, Jesse Waters, he wants to bomb the UN headquarters now.
Over this.
Well, you know, it just so happens, guys, that on the CBOE, everybody has a job, right? And I was a floor official, and I was right, my spot in the OEX, because everybody stood in the same spot every day, not everybody, but knuckleheads like me did. I was right near this one escalator, and if there was any kind of a fire emergency, my job was to run over and hit the button you just talked about and stop that escalator.
Yeah.
So I know right where the button is, and could you kick it in error? Yeah, you could. I mean, could you hit it with something if you're carrying something? It's down on the bottom, right down on the bottom. There's like two buttons, and if you look close, they're there. Because anybody... If somebody gets caught on there, or somebody gets caught in the thing, which happens, I mean, if somebody's arm gets caught, there has to be a manual shutoff. If you know where it is, somebody hits the button and it stops.
Sure. And you know what's amazing? If you look at the video, there's another up escalator that's working right next to that one. And if that was you or me, wouldn't you just like back up and then go on the one next to it that was working?
There has to be a plot. Again, it's a crazy world. But you know, the funny part is it's not the funny part. It's kind of scary. He doesn't even have to say anything. He's got his people essentially on these other stations that expand on this, and everybody believes it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I don't quite.
It's not journalism. I don't know what category you would put that into, but it's.
What's with this latest thing from the Speaker of the House that Trump was actually an FBI agent, and he was stalking Epstein? He wasn't a buddy of his or something?
Hey, remember Elvis was a DEA agent. Nixon made him one.
Well,
officially.
Well, you know,
well, that goes to a private joke. Wayne and I often have, whenever we come across a judge arrested for, you know, kiddie porn, or and they always say, "Well, I was doing research," you know.
Well, you know.
Yeah, they still use that excuse.
Well, how did Andrew? You mentioned one day that your mother ended up. I mean, I read like A Man Called Intrepid and things like that, where in World War II, basically anybody, if for instance any of the three of us could sing or something, and we were on one of these USO tours, we would be staying in some of the nicer hotels, and guess what? The three of us would be down in a bar having a cocktail, and we'd be talking to people. Well, anybody who's like that, you know, the CIA wasn't around at the time, but it would have been, was it OCC, whatever those guys were, they would come to us and say, "Hey, look, here's my number. If you ever hear anything, let me know," right? I mean, there was all these fingers out everywhere, right? It doesn't mean we were an agent. It doesn't mean we were getting paid. How did your mom get contacted and get involved?
Well, she started as a housewife in Oak Lawn, Illinois, right?
That's right where I grew up in Evergreen Park, so I know right where you're at.
Writing stories about crime, organized crime, medicine, all kinds of stuff. And then she persuaded my father that to make it, we have to move to New York. And she started as a typist and became medical editor of Parents Magazine. And she got involved in very heavy duty investigations or just consumer stories. And to fast forward, she learned that the federal authorities were investigating mob and mafia counterfeiting of life-saving prescription drugs. And she really, as a, you know, journalist, reporter, wanted to get in on that. So she volunteered to work undercover and pretend to be part of the underworld and work actually with the federal authorities.
Your dad is okay with this?
Yeah, he was a good guy. He was running our Boy Scout troop and deacon at the church, and really a good guy. So at one point, she pretended to be a madam who needed prescription drugs for her girls, and she ended up writing a book, Black Market Medicine, about this in 1967, and became the star witness at one of the first congressional hearings to focus on the mafia, because this remember that before Joe Valachi started talking, and after 1963. People would know Al Capone and Dillinger, and these guys were part of a mob, but they didn't really understand the structure until the late 60s. So she was testifying this, and I remember the first part of her testimony as a reporter, as a mother, as a citizen, we've got to stop the mob from counterfeiting life-saving prescription drugs. So this was you know, kind of a big deal, very courageous. Obviously, I'm proud of it.
What parish were you in, Oak Lawn? I'll test your roots.
Well, I can say it was totally drilled into me to remember my address, 4328 West 100th Street.
That's like a mile from where I grew up.
Well, I'll remember another thing. I was just a little kid.
By the way, that's Queen of Martyrs.
Oh, really? Oh.
We were 2920, 102nd place.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that's why we get on, or at least we understand the South Side accent. I remember one time she was taking me across the street, and there was a sparrow that had been run over by all kinds of trucks, and she said, "Look at that sparrow. He didn't watch where he was going. Don't let that happen to you."
God. Well, you know, at the same time, my uncle was undercover in Cicero for the county police, doing some mob work out there. Different. We're talking about gambling places and stuff. And he knew all those guys. Matter of fact, I think he did a favor for him once. I'll tell you this guy's a story over drinks some night. It's not for publication, but he did a favor for him, and he refused to take any money. And they didn't know what to do. They had the envelope, and he goes, "No, I'm not taking any money. I did you guys a favor because I thought it was the right thing to do." And they didn't know what to do. Because they wanted to own everybody. And if you didn't take the dough, they didn't own you. He just did them a favor. It was weird. I mean, I'm sure your mom knows all about that. You know, you can have dinner with people, have breakfast, just don't ever get involved with the cash part of it. And it was almost like a different world that you weren't even involved in.
Well, I still constantly follow that world. I've got maybe 30 books about the mob and mafia of different cities right 10 feet away from me. And what you're saying is lessons from life. And just kind of quickly, because I was a reporter covering this stuff too later, what's interesting is that the mob learned from the movies part of it. So it was, I covered actually the first RICO trial under the Racketeering Act. And, you know, the by that time, the Godfather movies and a lot of other movies were coming out. And people kind of learned how to act from the movies that were based on the old timers.
Well, yeah, The Untouchables too.
Yeah, or the Walter Winchell.
Yeah.
Well, I'll kind of leave it for there. But
well, it was when the real my grandfather, obviously, how old would he be? They knew it as the Black Hand. It wasn't called the Mafia; it was called the Black Hand. Everybody knew who the guys were and so forth, and they were in the hood, and you know there was some protection and all that kind of stuff. That one, it was very close to the first scene, and not the first scene, the scene with Fanucci and The Godfather. You know, you paid tribute to this guy or that guy, and sort of like you do the government now. But I mean, it's all sort of the same. It's just people organizing themselves. It was almost like private police force or whatever. I mean, it served a purpose to a point. You know, always to a point. But yeah, I mean, where do you guys? I mean, we have this incredible stuff where people are believing things, but is it just? I think that a lot of the people on the show think I'm against it, but not or against their thoughts on this. How much of what we're seeing now with the current administration, the advancements and so forth, and we have an FCC guy on TV talking about, you have a license, so you know we're watching you, kind of thing. And David Favor actually asked him, "Have you heard this? Well, does that mean we got to put a script in front of you for approval?" And he was kind of shocked at the question, because David Favor, I think, is a pretty good reporter. And he goes, "Well, something like not yet, or no, we're not at that stage, or something like that." I mean, to a certain extent, and my Republican people are absolutely not wrong, the sense that there was a boatload of censorship going on regarding COVID, first in
in Trump's first administration and accelerated by Biden, that he didn't pull back on it, there's been a tremendous amount of censorship from the left, as well as, you know, this explosion in whatever you want to call it, everybody, media or whatever. Everybody seems to want to control what everybody else does. I mean, people want to buy newspapers. People want to control X. They want to control this. It's not just... part of me says, you know, I've never been a Trump fan. I didn't like the guy before he was president. So, but that's not... Part of me, really, I think he's very adept at realizing we're already down this road. He didn't start it.
Well, he didn't start it, but it's not the same.
I agree. But, I mean, it's almost to the point where... you know, I go back and I bore you guys with this. Yeah. You know, I go back to, I was never a big watcher of Boardwalk Empire. I remember watching the first couple of them, and they knock off this booze truck, right? And Nucky's involved, right? So they pass out the money, and it's the first time he'd ever done anything like that. So he gets his envelope. Well, the guys go out and knock off another truck, and they come in and they give him the envelope, and he goes, I didn't have any part of that. The guy says, I'm Nucky, you can't be half a gangster. You know, you're either in or you're not. And I think the censorship having to do with... I mean, I told everybody on the show that my person I know who is a doctor got a letter from state of Illinois saying, if you say anything questioning the COVID shots, we're going to take your license away. Well, hell, in that industry, for how many years, guys... was every doctor's opinion supposed to be valued and supposed to... Now everybody, if you're a doctor, you got to work for three or four companies. And you can't do anything on your own. You can't give a prescription without them knowing about it. I had two really good people in the last 2 weeks. I wanted to get on the show. Their bosses want no part of it. You can't go on TV or radio. I mean, the censorship is all over the place. It's from big companies. It's from the Democratic administration. It's from these guys. They're taking it to a new level, but they didn't start it.
The danger for I'm here in Florida, where our Surgeon General basically says no more vaccinations for kids and to go to school. Well, Disney World and the other theme parks had already taken a hit because foreigners aren't coming here anymore, are taking another hit from tourists out of state. Who wants to bring their kids to a theme park, many of which are water rides? Remember during polio, they closed swimming pools and even beaches when there was a polio outbreak.
And my parents were, well, Andrew, you're a little older than me. I'll bet your parents were paranoid about you getting polio.
There was a kid right down the street on 100th Street who had polio, you know, and he couldn't barely leave the house. You know, it was tragic, and there was lots of it. And you've got literally a nut running the Florida department.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about.
I can't get a COVID booster here, so I'm actually getting on a plane after the show here and flying up to D.C. Most to see Andy, but also I'm going to take advantage of it to go to the drugstore and get a COVID booster.
Hey, you know, you're not supposed to drink for 3 days if you get one of those COVID boosters.
Yeah.
that's off the table. Actually, Wayne is really coming up because he's got his 25-year pin at a ceremony at the National Press Club. But let me go back to something very important. Censorship is... actions by the government, and we shouldn't underplay what this FCC chairman was talking about. It was a direct threat by the head of the FCC that he will take the licenses because he doesn't like what Kimmel said, and then it turns out that that's on the actions of President Trump. Now, that is government censorship.
Sure it is.
And a number of the other things we've been talking about, but that are also in the public mind, they're by private entities. And all of us, particularly Wayne and me, who are active journalists and have been, let's call it edited, where the editor or the attorneys for the outlet said, well, we can't quite go with that. And a lot of times we as reporters, researchers, and maybe our immediate editors say, no, it's solid, we got it. And then higher up, they say, no, you can't do it. Well, that's, you know, we as researchers, reporters, might object to that, but it's not censorship. It's
it is if one of the guys who owns the biggest company owns the paper.
Yeah. And so we live with that reality all the time. We might object to it publicly or privately, but that's the system. But it can't be confused with totally outrageous, unprecedented actions.
Let's tee this up next week. We got to go. But what I'm trying to split here is, and you know, I'm 100% with you on this. But what I'm trying to split hairs here. I can either come out as a censor from the bully pulpit, but if I really want to be sneaky, if a firm's doing business with government, which everybody seems to be doing now, I just tell the chairman, by the way, I don't really want any of this kind of crap coming out of your newspaper.
Well, that's, by the way, I know you got to go, but that's also a mob tactic.
Yeah, well, without a doubt.
Let's remember that Trump's mentor, friend, and advisor and nightclub buddy was Roy Cohn, who represented three of the five New York Mafia
and it's
nice daughter you got there. I noticed she gets out of school at 3:02. Yeah. Every day. It would be a shame if anything happened.
Well, who wrote the last note here? Who wrote the book? You guys remember it. Maybe Jimmy will. University of Chicago professor wrote the book on Southside gangs and how they're organized just like a business. Or the mob, they're all the same. Pretty much. How you organize them and how you keep discipline and who gets to say what and all those types of things, it's all the same. Because we are all just people, right?
Yep.
All right, guys. I wish I was in Washington if you two guys were both there. where are you staying, the Willard?
No, I'm staying at a hotel about 6 blocks north of Andy, I think. I used to stay at Andy's place, but I don't want to have to put him to all that trouble of, you know.
You bring in all the girls in and everything else. And
all night long.
Yeah. What's the name of the other bar in the, behind the White House, but the bar's in the basement?
The one at the Mayflower.
No, not the Mayflower. It's another. It's two names. Hey, Hayes Adams or Hayes something.
Yeah,
something.
Hey Adams.
That's a great little bar in there.
Yeah, I think it's called the Reliable Source or something like that.
You got to go downstairs, and all the guys from the White House are staring at the tube, and if something happens, they all scurry back across the street.
Yeah.
We've got a story for next time about trying to track down the bars around there, the infiltrated by spies that were arranging honey trap operations.
Well, when we go out there, we can be infiltrated by Stocks and Jacks. Maybe we'll bring Jimmy with. Take care, guys. S&P futures down 35. NASDAQ futures down 182. Another kind of crummy day looking like here. We'll see if we bounce back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.